This is Age of Treason Radio. On the White Network.
And Daddy always smiled, took me by the hand, saying someday you'll understand. Well, I'm here to tell you now that you never know it's gone. You better learn it fast, you better learn it young, 'cause someday it never comes.
With your host, Tan Stoffel.
Welcome. The title of this installment is Race and Anthropology Part 2. It's more on Madison Grant and specifically the passing of the great race. I'm going to read almost entirely. This will be readings from the passing of the great race. I have just one digression to make, so let me get right to it. I'm going to start with the fourth edition introduction. It starts, the passing of the great race. And this is from 1921. The fourth edition was now 5-6 years after the original publication in 1916. The passing of the great race in its original form was designed by the author to rouse his fellow Americans to the overwhelming importance of race and to the folly of the melting pot theory. He writes melting pot in quotes. Even at the expense of bitter controversy, this purpose has been accomplished thoroughly, and one of the most far-reaching effects of the doctrine enunciated in this volume and in the discussions that followed its publication was the decision of the Congress of the United States to adopt discriminatory and restrictive measures against the immigration of undesirable races and peoples. He's referring there to the immigration restriction laws of the 1920s that Madison Grant was had a large role in motivating. So he's rightly taking credit there for it. Another of the results has been the publication in America and Europe of a series of books and articles more or less anthropological in character, which have sustained or controverted its main theme. The new definition of race and the controlling role played by race in all the manifestations of what we call civilization are now generally accepted even by those whose political position depends upon popular favor. This is a point I've been trying to make this whole series on science, the race science, is that these men who were doing this work were all mainstream. They were exemplars, actually, of the intellectual class, leaders of in society and geniuses, including Madison Grant. Just one sour note here he strikes is when he's talking to rouse his fellow Americans. Well, I guess at the time, his fellow Americans were a majority Nordic people, or at least a very large part. But he's sort of glossing over there the distinction he himself makes between the different types of white people, between the different types of Europeans, and that it's really Nordics that he's most concerned about. And that I mentioned at the tail end last time that I was going to talk about Nordicism. Well, this is Nordicism. The concern, sort of in the way racism is concern for the white race. That's what the word has come to mean. You know, an irrational, pejorative concern for the white race. It's stupid, crazy, and evil. Nordicism has started out initially, I think, as a positive thing. Like Madison Grant was a Nordicist. I'm not sure if he ever called himself that, but you could see, simply identifying him as that, to be more specific, that he was a racialist, somebody who accepted the reality of race, but he was mainly concerned about the Nordic people. He considered himself Nordic and was concerned mainly about that subset of people. But it has, in modern times, come to have a pejorative meaning, that it's people who are irrationally concerned only about Nordic peoples. I don't think that the concern is irrational at all. Let me continue here. There exists today, and at some point in this reading, it transitions into the book itself, the book proper, but I didn't make a note of where that begins. There exists today a widespread and fatuous belief in the power of environment, as well as of education and opportunity to alter heredity. which arises from the dogma of the brotherhood of man, derived in its turn from the loose thinkers of the French Revolution and their American mimics. Such beliefs have done much damage in the past, and if allowed to go uncontradicted, may do even more serious damage in the future. Thus, the view that the Negro slave was an unfortunate cousin of the white man, deeply tanned by the tropic sun and denied the blessings of Christianity and civilization, played no small part with the sentimentalists of the Civil War period. It has taken us 50 years to learn that speaking English, wearing good clothes, and going to school and to church do not transform a Negro into a white man. Nor was a Syrian or Egyptian freedman transformed into a Roman by wearing a toga and applauding his favorite gladiator in the amphitheater. Americans will have a similar experience with the Polish Jew, whose dwarf stature, peculiar mentality, and ruthless concentration on self-interest are being engrafted upon the stock of the nation. He's making a point here, Grant is, that I mentioned, I think, a couple of installments ago when speaking about Fritz Lenz. And Fritz Lenz was expressing pretty much the same idea, that just because Jews can speak German and in fact, study and become experts on Goethe, famous German poet, that they would become Germans, and that was false. It was a false idea. Recent attempts have been made in the interest of inferior races among our immigrants to show that the shape of the skull does change, not merely in a century, but in a single generation. And here, let me say that Grant is, in talking about inferior races among our immigrants, he's talking about Jews, because it's specifically Boas, Franz Boas, who was the one who was doing this work on skull shape. That's who he's referring to. In 1910, the report of the anthropological expert of the Congressional Immigration Commission gravely declared that a round skull Jew on his way across the Atlantic might and did have a round skull child. But a few years later, in response to the subtle elixir of American institutions as exemplified in an East Side tenement, might and did have a child whose skull was appreciably longer, and that a long skull South Italian breeding freely would have precisely the same experience in the reverse direction. In other words, the melting pot was acting instantly under the influence of a changed environment. I don't like this style of writing. This is sarcasm, and sarcasm is a weak form of argument. Madison Grant, I thought, was, and I still do think, is most of the time very direct and blunt. But in this, he's euphemizing. He's dancing around the Jews. I think this is a reflection, really, of the growing influence of Jews in America, the power that they had, and that at this point, Grant and his allies were already losing to Boas and his. And this must have been from the 1921, the preface to the, or introduction to the fourth edition of the book. What the melting pot actually does in practice can be seen in Mexico, where the absorption of the blood of the original Spanish conquerors by the native Indian population has produced the racial mixture which we call Mexican, and which is now, today we call it mestizo, and which is now engaged in demonstrating its capacity or its incapacity for self-government. The world has seen many such mixtures, and the character of a mongrel race is only just beginning to be understood at its true value. It must be borne in mind that the specializations which characterize the higher races are of relatively recent development, are highly unstable, and when mixed with generalized or primitive characters tend to disappear. Whether we like to admit it or not, the result of the mixture of the two races in the long run gives us a race reverting to the more ancient, generalized, and lower type. The cross between a white man and an Indian is an Indian. The cross between a white man and a Negro is a Negro. The cross between a white man and a Hindu is a Hindu. And the cross between any of the three European races and a Jew is a Jew. In the crossing of the blonde and brunette elements of a population, the more deeply rooted and ancient dark traits are prepotent or dominant. This is matter of everyday observation, and the working of this law of nature is not influenced or affected by democratic institutions or by religious beliefs. Nature cares not for the individual nor how he may be modified by environment. She is concerned only with the perpetuation of the species or type, and heredity alone is the medium through which she acts. Now, Grant here refers several times in this section to the melting pot. And that too is a reference to the Jews indirectly. Now he does refer directly to the Jews, and he says very specifically that a cross between any of the three European races and a Jew is a Jew. I think he's right about that. I think that in general, people who are partly Jewish can be trusted to exhibit the characteristics of Jews and ideologically can be trusted most of the time to stand with the Jews in any conflict between Jews and Europeans, most of the time. I note here that he does use the term white. Just because Grant was a Nordicist and considered race to be a concept that was applied at the sub-European level and divided Europe into three separate races, that he didn't think that white was a useless concept or a useless term or a nonsensical term, or that it only meant not black. He obviously saw white as having use, but he quite deliberately stopped when he was making his comparisons between white men and Indians and a cross between white men and Negro and a white man and Hindu. He very deliberately didn't say between a white man and a Jew, because as we see even today, it's even worse, is this conflation of Jews as white. But I do see here a little bit of tiptoeing around the Jews, and rather than facing them head on, he refers to them as the brunettes and as a inferior immigrant races, and he refers to the melting pot. As to the melting pot is a phrase that comes from, and it's an idea, a theme that comes from a Jew named Israel Zangwill. And Israel Zangwill was born in London in 1864, so the year before Madison Grant was born, in a family of Jewish immigrants from Tsarist Russia. He dedicated his life, this is from the Wikipedia page on him, he dedicated his life to championing the cause of the oppressed: Jewish emancipation, women's suffrage, assimilationism, territorialism, and Zionism. Those last three all have to do with the Jews. In fact, he was completely obsessed with promoting Jewish interests. He married a non-Jew, a feminist named Edith Ayrton, which explains, I guess, his interest in women's suffrage. The use of the metaphorical phrase melting pot to describe American absorption of immigrants was popularized by Zangwill's play, titled The Melting Pot, a hit in the United States in 1909 and 1910. Melting Pot celebrated America's capacity to absorb and grow from the contributions of its immigrants. Zangwill, who had already left Zionism, was writing, quote, as, quote, a Jew who no longer wanted to be a Jew. His real hope was for a world in which the entire lexicon of racial and religious difference is thrown away. That is a misleading at best, and it's really a lie. The claim that Zangwill was a Jew who no longer wanted to be a Jew comes from Lord Chief Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, whom I've mentioned in a previous installment on moralizing, and he's a good example of exactly how Jews exist only because they have never really ever tried to deliver on this hope for a world in which the entire lexicon of racial and religious difference is thrown away. They want everyone else to throw away their racial identity and religious differences and overlook those differences. But the Jews themselves are absolutely obsessed with what's best for the Jews and that the Jews continue. The word assimilationism, which is another one of Zangwill's interests, is one of these doublethink words where it means one thing to white people and it means something totally different to Jews. Assimilationism to whites is generally thought of as a good thing. It's what immigrants are supposed to do when they move to your country. They're supposed to try to become absorbed into the dominant culture and become part of the nation that they are moving to. That's the idea. And from a Jewish point of view, assimilationism is one step away from genocide. They see assimilationism as a threat to themselves as Jews. If they were to assimilate, Jews would cease to be. And so it's in this very deeply dishonest doublethink that we have to sort of read between the lines here or correct for the kind of things that we see written in Wikipedia today about Jews, concerning Jews. Just one last thing here, one last paragraph about Zangwill. After having for a time supported Theodor Herzl and the main Palestine-oriented Zionist movement, Zangwill broke away from the established movement and founded his own organization called the Jewish Territorialist Organization in 1905. This is just 4 years before writing the Melting Pot, telling Americans that they should all blend together and forget their differences. Its aim was to create a Jewish territorialist organization in 1905. Its aim was to create a Jewish homeland in whatever possible territory in the world could be found, and not necessarily in what today is the state of Israel. Zangwill died in 1926 in Midhurst, West Sussex, after trying to create the Jewish state in such diverse places as Canada, Australia, Mesopotamia, Uganda, and Cyrenaica, which it turns out is the eastern half of what's called Libya today. So that's Zangwill and his play, The Melting Pot, and where the phrase The Melting Pot comes from, which many of us learned about The Melting Pot. That was the view taught from the 1960s on, at least, the positive view of how immigration was supposed to work in America. I think that's totally broken down now, of course, and now non-whites are not expected in any way to melt. They're expected to, that would be racist for us to even expect them to change in any way. They don't have to change. It's us that have to assimilate and adapt to them, or at least that's the expectation, the Jewish expectation now. Back to Madison Grant, who I find much more pleasant to read. In dealing with European populations, the best method of determining race has been found to lie in a comparison of proportions of the skull. And here he's going to get into the details of this skull measurements, which he's already alluded to in talking about the efforts of Boas to describe the plasticity of skull proportions. This comparison of proportions of the skull, which is the so-called cephalitic index. This is the ratio of the maximum width taken at the widest part of the skull above the ears to maximum length. Skulls with an index of 75 or less, that is, those with a width that is 3/4 of the length or less, are considered dolichocephalitic, or long skulls. Skulls with an index of 80 or over are round, or brachiocephalitic skulls. Intermediate indices between 75 and 80 are considered mesatocephalitic. These are cranial indices. To allow for the flesh on the living specimens, about 2% is to be added to this index, and the result is the cephalitic index. In the following pages, only long and round skulls are considered in the intermediate forms, and the intermediate forms are assigned to the dolichocephalitic group. This cephalitic index, though an extremely important, if not controlling, character, is nevertheless but a single character and must be checked up with other somatological traits, meaning physical traits. Normally, a long skull is associated with a long face, and a round skull with a round face. To use this test, the cephalitic index enables us to divide the great bulk. The use of this test, the cephalitic index, enables us to divide the great bulk of the European populations into three distinct subspecies of man: one northern, one southern, both dolichocephalitic, or characterized by a long skull, and a central subspecies, which is brachiocephalitic, or characterized by a round skull. The first is the Nordic or Baltic subspecies. This race is long-skulled, very tall, fair-skinned, with blonde or brown hair, and light-colored eyes. The Nordics inhabit the countries around the North and Baltic Seas and include not only the great Scandinavian and Teutonic groups, but also other early peoples who first appear in southern Europe and in Asia as representatives of Aryan language and culture. The second is the dark Mediterranean or Iberian subspecies, occupying the shores of the Inland Sea and extending along the Atlantic coast until it reaches the Nordic species. It also spreads far east into southern Asia. It is long skulled like the Nordic race, but the absolute size of the skull is less. The eyes and hair are very dark or black, and the skin is more or less swarthy. The stature is distinctly less than that of the Nordic race, and the musculature and bony framework weak. The third is the Alpine subspecies, occupying all Central and Eastern Europe and extending through Asia Minor to the Hindu Kush and the Pamirs. The Arminoids constitute an Alpine subdivision and may possibly represent the ancestral type of this race, which remained in the mountains and high plateau of Anatolia and Western Asia. The Alpines are round-skulled, of medium height and sturdy build, both as to skeleton and muscles. The coloration of both hair and eyes was originally very dark and still tends strongly in that direction, but many light-colored eyes, especially gray, are now common among the Alpine populations of Western Europe. While the inhabitants of Europe betray as a whole their mixed origin, nevertheless, individuals of each of the three main subspecies are found in large numbers and in great purity, as well as sparse remnants of still more ancient races represented by small groups or by individuals and even by single characters. He's referring there to the Neanderthal and the Cro-Magnon, although he doesn't mention them by name. These three main groups have bodily characters which constitute them distinct subspecies. Each group is a large one and includes several well-marked varieties, which differ even more widely in cultural development than in physical divergence, so that when the Mediterranean of England is compared with the Hindu, or the Alpine Savoyard with the Romanian or Turkoman, a wide gulf is found. In zoology, related species, when grouped together, constitute subgenera and genera, and the term species implies the existence of a certain definite amount of divergence from the most closely related type. But race does not require a similar amount of difference. In man, where all the groups more or less are more or less fertile when crossed, so many intermediate or mixed types occur that the word species has at the present day too extended a meaning. So he's addressing the equivalence or unequivalence of race and species, as I've discussed before. Skipping ahead a little bit here, eye color is of very great importance in race determination because all blue, gray, or green eyes in the world today come originally from the same source, namely the Nordic race of Northern Europe. This light-colored eye has appeared nowhere else on Earth, is a specialization of this subspecies of man only, and consequently is of extreme value in the classification of European races. Dark-colored eyes are all but universal among wild mammals, and entirely so among the primates, man's nearest relatives. It may be taken as an absolute certainty that all the original races of man had dark eyes. One subspecies of man, and one alone, specialized in light-colored eyes. Blonde hair also comes everywhere from the Nordic subspecies and from nowhere else. Whenever we find blondness among the darker races of the earth, we may be sure some Nordic wanderer has passed that way. It must be clearly understood that blondness of hair and of eye is not a final test of Nordic race. The Nordics include all the blondes, and also those of darker hair or eye when possessed of a preponderance of other Nordic characters. In this sense, the word blonde means those of lighter shades of hair or eye color in contrast to the very dark or black shades, which are termed brunette. I trimmed out there just the sections about eye color and hair color, but he also discusses quite a bit red hair and fair skin, and freckles, and all of that. It's very fascinating stuff. While the three main European races are the subject of this book, and while it is not the intention of the author to deal with the other human types, it is desirable in connection with the discussion of this character, hair, to state that the three European subspecies are subdivisions of one of the primary groups or species of the genus Homo, which, taken together, we may call the Caucasian, for lack of a better name. The existing classification of man must be radically revised, as the differences between the most divergent human types are far greater than are usually deemed sufficient to constitute separate species and even subgenera in the animal kingdom at large. Outside of the three European subspecies, the greater portion of the genus Homo can be roughly divided into the Negroes and Negroids and the Mongols and Mongoloids. The environment of the Alpine race, skipping ahead again, seems to have always been the mountainous country of Central and Eastern Europe, as well as Western Asia, but they are now spreading into the plains, notably in Poland and Russia. This type has never flourished in the deserts of Arabia or the Sahara, nor has it succeeded well in maintaining its early colonies in the northwest of Europe within the domain of Nordic longheads. It is, however, a sturdy and persistent stock, and while much of it may not be over-refined or cultured, undoubtedly possesses great potentialities for future development. The Alpines in the west of Europe, especially in Switzerland and the districts immediately surrounding, have been so thoroughly Nordicized and so saturated with the culture of the adjoining nations that they stand in sharp contrast to backward Alpines of Slavic speech in the Balkans and east of Europe. The Mediterranean race, on the other hand, is clearly a southern type with eastern affinities. It is a type that did not endure in the north of Europe until under former agricultural conditions, nor is it suitable to the farming districts and frontiers of America and Canada. It is adjusted to the subtropical and tropical countries better than any other European type and will flourish in our southern states and around the coasts of the Spanish Main. In France, it is well known that members of the Mediterranean races are better adapted for colonization in Algeria than are the French Alpines or Nordics. This subspecies of man is notoriously intolerant of extreme cold owing to its susceptibility to diseases of the lungs, and it shrinks from the blasts of the northern winter in which the Nordics revel. The brunette Mediterranean element in the Native American, and here, this is funny. In Madison Grant's time, Native American meant white American, native-born white American. In the Native American seems to be increasing at the expense of the blonde Nordic element, generally throughout the southern states, and probably also in the large cities. This type of man, however, is scarce on our frontiers. In the Northwest and in Alaska, in the days of the gold rush, it was in the mining camps a matter of comment if a man turned up with dark eyes. So universal were blue and gray eyes among the American pioneers. This is an interesting paragraph here, expressing Grant's resentment of the Mediterranean type. I mean, here he sees them in competition. The Mediterranean in competition with the Nordic, and he sees differences, obvious differences between the Nordic and the Mediterranean. Now here's a section that I'll get into next time. I'm out of time in this installment. I hope you all had a very white Christmas, and please join me the next time. I'll talk a little bit about Madison Grant's opinions on eugenics.